My name is Michael McCusker. Those few fumbling seconds of silence were my trying to find the microphone, which I had got it out of my sight there for a moment. Well, tomorrow is my baby sister Mary Antonina's 66th birthday. I remember when she was a super smart little girl with pigtails who was the gang boss of the neighborhood. Sunday is the USMC's, the U.S. Marine Corps, 238th birthday, which segues into so-called Veterans Day, Monday, November 11th, once known all over the world as Armistice Day, and it is the subject of this program. So I'd like to give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only. In all of the cosmos, at least two of the stories I'm going to read. The one in the middle is by my friend Rick Rubin, and he needs no disclaimers or apologies. Death's citizens. Soldiers are citizens of death's gray land, drawing no dividend from time's tomorrows. And that's from a line of a poem written by Siegfried Sassoon, who was one of World War I's famous soldier poets. And this is one of the stories I wrote. Death's citizens. It is 95 years since the great slaughter ended at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of the 18th year of the 20th century. By the time World War I ended, the empires and societies of pre-war Europe had vanished or were disrupted beyond recognition. The war to end wars was the beginning of the final triumph of the Industrial Revolution. Flesh yielded to steel. The shells that fell upon its soldiers like rain for 4 years, 3 months, and 1 week made mockeries of courage, fear, and sacrifice, pummeled them into bloody particles and blotches. Whom the shells missed, the machine guns harvested. No other war was as atrocious to its soldiers except the American Civil War half a century earlier. In each, the infantry was charged en masse into sure death, and the battlefields of both wars were littered with the corpses of thousands. Rapid advances in weaponry were not matched in either war by changes in tactics. Civil War leaders charged their troops into mass formations of riflemen and artillery. World War I generals sent their soldiers against barbed wire and machine guns. The paralyzing trench warfare of the latter war was a desperate innovation of the former. The short, miserable life of soldiers was never more grim than the stagnant war of attrition fought on the Western Front of Europe from late 1914, 100 years ago, next year, when the Summer's War of Movement settled into trench warfare until the armistice 4 years later. More than 10 million were counted dead, the majority of them soldiers. The next war, a generation later, would decimate many times more civilians than combatants as a result of technological improvements in artillery, long-range bombing, and the development of nuclear power. World War I was a short-range war. Artillery and airplanes were not able to kill at long range as they later were. Soldiers were the main targets and were ceaselessly under attack by artillery barrages that lasted for days and were bombed and machine gunned from the air. Poisoned gas and infantry-fired machine guns were primarily aimed at soldiers unable to escape them, the poor unknowns whose deaths prematurely consumed an entire generation of European men, and hundreds of thousands of colonial troops from Asia and Africa were slaughtered, plus thousands more from Australia and North America. It was a soldiers' war, perhaps the last one in which soldiers did most of the killing and dying. Armistice is defined as a temporary truce, but to the American president, Woodrow Wilson, the armistice 95 years ago this November 11th was to be an end to war forever. He died a few years later, miserably aware his plan for a League of Nations had failed and that small wars were even then erupting all over the planet. Hundreds of millions had prayed for his success, and Armistice Day became a symbol of peace to the world's ordinary people who suffer horribly during times of war. Each Armistice Day, a full minute of silence was observed at the 11th hour in memory of the fallen. By the time German armies invaded Poland, September 1, 1939, millions who had hoped for peace were already dead from wars, assassinations, mass executions, pogroms. 57 million more died in the following 6 years. All but the Western Hemisphere was ravaged by World War II, but at the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century, every place on the planet remains vulnerable to nuclear-armed missiles, everywhere about a half hour away from annihilation. The only alternative to nuclear holocaust is disarmament and the destruction of nuclear weapons, yet those who possess them derive their power from their arsenals in making treaties that allow for more and deadlier weapons. All of them who survived World War I are finally dead, joining at last their comrades who died in the trenches and on the wire in no man's land. The World War II generation, so young in the countless replay of 1940s war movies, is old now and dying at a rapid rate. Soon, Vietnam veterans will be the aged war survivors, following the exit of those who fought in Korea. Newer generations endure newer wars, as if the litany of horror human beings perpetrate upon each other will never end. In the United States, Armistice Day is now devoted to veterans. Instead of recalling war's cost, the day celebrates veterans as superior citizens for their service to the state. The day that ended the first of the 20th century's great slaughters, and which was a day that humanity expressed its longing for a peaceful world, is dangerously trivialized into an effort to recruit more offerings to Mars. And that was something I wrote. Death Citizens, from Siegfried Sassoon's poem. And now a story by a friend of mine who lives in Portland, Rick Rubin. Veterans of America, I salute you. Annually, on November 11th, it is our duty as patriotic citizens to honor American veterans of all our wars, the brave men and women, whether clerk typists in Korea or expert infantrymen in Kansas, who have actually or potentially defended our American way of life. Personally, I feel this day is one of the more significant of our American holidays, and each year I try to pause and remember one or more specific groups of veterans. I say specific because there are more than 25 million veterans in the country who, together with their immediate families, make up two-fifths of the population. You can't salute them all at once. A person needs something more concrete. For example, one group I delight in honoring is the veterans of the 25th U.S. Infantry Regiment, parentheses, colored, six of whom had won the Medal of Honor in the Philippines at the beginning of the 20th century. Back home at a stateside army fort, a dozen or so members of this organization, angered by the treatment they had received from the white citizens of nearby Brownsville, Texas, made what has been described, by white people at least, as a shooting sortie into the town, killing one citizen. Whether any man of the 25th Regiment had ever been killed by the citizens of Brownsville, I can't say, but I am reasonably certain that no one had ever been convicted of doing so. The soldiers returned to their post unobserved, and during the subsequent official investigation, not one of the 160 men of the three colored companies would inform on his fellow soldiers. On November 5th, President Theodore Roosevelt discharged, quote, without honor, every man of the three companies, observing that if no one admitted guilt, all of them would have to pay the penalty. The discharge without honor meant all pensions and payments were forfeited, including those of the six Medal of Honor winners, and none of the men was ever reinstated or given a pension. And so each year I salute the veterans of Brownsville. Would it seem so unsophisticated if I salute the Americans to die under Hitler's, the first Americans to die under Hitler's bullets, to be blown to heroes' graves by Mussolini's airplanes? American veterans of the American Lincoln Brigade of the Spanish Civil War, I salute you on Veterans Day. I salute those other unlucky veterans, communists and socialists, German-American Bundists, the homosexuals and psychotics and other disreputable types who were drafted into the Army in time of war and were then, though not actually convicted of any crime, discharged under circumstances less than honorable to hunt for jobs as best they knew how. I salute the veterans of Coxey's Army who in 1894 marched on Washington, D.C. to petition for relief legislation and bonuses for veterans, but were instead rushed by guards, shot and injured, and saw their leaders arrested for the crime of trampling on the grass. And I do not forget to honor the World War I Veterans Bonus Army marchers of 1932. Several policemen were injured while evicting them from vacant government buildings where they were living, and in the process killed two of their number. The army was called in by President Herbert Hoover and, led by General Douglas MacArthur, advanced in full battle dress with machine guns, tanks, tear gas, drawn sabers, and fixed bayonets. General MacArthur observed the marchers were animated by the essence of revolution, quote unquote, and further commented that if President Hoover had let it go another week, I believe the institutions of our government would have been severely threatened. So to be fair, I salute not only the Bonus Army of 1932, but also the soldiers who attacked them and subsequently became veterans themselves. And further, I salute Veteran General MacArthur. I salute the Negro combat troops of World War I who served with French divisions overseas so as not to cause trouble and won many citations for bravery under fire, perhaps the only veterans of our history who not only had to learn foreign weapons in foreign military organization, but even a foreign language just to serve their own army in time of war. And I further salute some who returned home from World War I and were among the 70 Negroes, several still in uniform, who were lynched during the first post-war year. Even if they had learned uppity ways from those alien Frenchmen, they were American veterans nonetheless. Of course, the first veterans I hail each year are my own comrades in arms of the Korean police action, who, if they were less than totally successful as soldiers, were less successful still at draft dodging, although many no doubt now march in the parades of November 11th. Then I move on to other defenders of the American dream, the Nisi members of the 442nd Infantry Regiment and the 100th Battalion, who voluntarily joined the Army out of concentration camps across California, Idaho, and Utah, won 5 distinguished unit citations with the 5th Army in Italy and the 7th Army in the Rhineland, and are said to be the most decorated regimental combat team in American history. Then they returned home to such places as Hood River, Oregon, to find the American Legion did not want a bunch of lousy Japs repossessing their lawful homes and farms. The government they had served voluntarily and well was prepared to pay depreciated 1945 prices for their cars, equipment, and other possessions confiscated in 1942. I salute the American Legionnaires who castrated, hanged then, shot full of holes, one Wesley Everest from a railroad bridge near Centralia, Washington, on Armistice Day 1919, and thereby defended the American way of life against the 8-hour day and other such foreign-inspired wobbly, IWW, demands. I salute sharp-eyed American Legionnaire Homer Shiloh, who reviewed a Legion pamphlet titled Americanism, What Is It? Legionnaire Shallow found the pamphlet contained too much emphasis on freedom of speech and too little on the fundamentals of religion. In addition, the paper was made in Japan, and the American eagle on the cover was printed in red. He forced the pamphlet, clearly un-American, to be withdrawn. I salute the Military Order of the World War, a group of former World War I officers who, in their national bulletin, reported that the American Civil Liberties Union actually, quote, believes in rampant free speech, unquote. I salute as well a man who, as colonel, shared with Ethan Allen leadership of the expedition that captured Fort Ticonderoga in 1775, who later that year led the capture of the fort at St. John's, and in 1776 almost captured Quebec, who attacked the British on Lake Champlain with a fleet of leaky small boats, and in 1777 repulsed an attempted invasion of Connecticut, who was wounded in the thick of fighting at Saratoga while leading his troops to victory, who commanded Philadelphia in 1778, West Point in 1780, and went on to become one of America's best-known veterans, Colonel Benedict Arnold. I salute you. I hail Private Edward Donald Slovic, called Eddie, one of thousands of American soldiers convicted of deserting in the face of the enemy during World War II, but the only one since 1864 to be executed for doing so. On January 31st, 1945, he was shot to death by a firing squad and rushed into veterandom. I salute Colonel Charles R. Forbes, commander of the Veterans Bureau under President Warren Harding, who, after Harding's death, was found to have operated a gigantic swindle which milked the Bureau of more than $200 million in less than 2 years. At a time when disabled veterans in hospitals lacked bandages, bedding, and drugs, Colonel Forbes condemned carloads of these items and sold them off at a fraction of their cost. I salute, too, the veterans of U.S. military actions other than declared wars. Hawaii, 1893, I beg your pardon. China, 1900. Panama, 1903. Dominican Republic, 1904. Nicaragua, 1911. Mexico, 1914. Haiti, 1915. Mexico, 1916. Dominican Republic, 1916. Who got just as dead, wounded just as painfully, but by some oversight, got no GI Bill, no homecoming parade, no veteran special bonuses, or even so much as a casualty statistic in the World Almanac. I salute the men who fought to destroy the dictatorship in Cuba, the anti-Batista fighters, now no more able to get a good job than those earlier anti-fascists, the men of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. I salute the Bay of Pigs invaders who, if they weren't either Americans or in the American Army, at least took our pay and did our work, however unsuccessfully. I salute the former officers and men of the Revolutionary War who participated in Captain Daniel Shea's Rebellion of 1786, an attempt to overthrow the government of Massachusetts. I salute the members of an alleged special group that is supposed to have spent World War II high up in Colorado, having been adjudged by the Army as too subversive to be of any use, but not subversive enough to kill or kick out or not draft in the first place. I salute veterans of the Revolution who knew it was right and proper for a people to throw off the shackles of an unjust government. And I salute the men of the Union Army in the Civil War, who knew that it was wrong and unlawful for a people to throw off the shackles of an unjust government. I salute American veterans who invaded Latin American countries to protect them from outside intervention, then invaded again to intervene on behalf of American property rights. In fact, I stand ready to salute any group or individual veteran who fits my peculiarly warped view of defenders of the American dream. I salute those first Americans to die for their country, the American Indians. I salute those Pilgrims, Puritans, and Protestants who killed them and were killed by them and thus became the second Americans to die for their country. I salute the soldiers, sailors, and airmen and women in Vietnam who died for some country, I'm not quite sure whose. Nor do I slight the American boys in the Congo, in Korea, in Formosa, Spain, and Morocco, nor the military advisory groups in dozens or perhaps even hundreds of other countries, all dying or at least ready to die without benefit or declared war or GI Bill of Rights in defense of freedom and the local USIS library. Veterans of America, myself included, I salute you. And that was Veterans of America, I Salute You, by Rick Rubin, who I believe still is a Portland artist and writer. This article was among the best of The Realist, printed by Running Press of Philadelphia, and was originally published in Realist 71, November 1966, and reprinted from the North Coast Times Eagle, Octonovo 2002. I haven't heard from Rick in many, many years. I hope he's doing okay. And now back to my disclaimer, an article I wrote. Again, The Last American Exiles. When you are in a war, you are already dead. And that's something Jim Josie, co-founder of Project Return, said. Which Project Return was for returning Vietnam veterans, and he shot himself on Thanksgiving 1978. A very good friend. The Last American Exiles. One New Year's Day, I learned that a friend was in a coma and dying in the Veterans Hospital in Portland. His name was Paul F. Cardwell, once a member of the U.S. Army's 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam. A man whose education, perceptions, and deep loyalties toward friends were forged in combat. What he learned from the war and what it made of him could not be contained by the strictures and illusions of the society he returned to, and he committed suicide through alcoholism. The day before he died on January 3, 1986, a doctor said that his 33-year-old liver resembled one of a man twice his age who drank every day of his life. When I last saw him the previous year, he was seriously undoing several months of alcohol therapy at a veterans detoxification center in southern Oregon. Friends, also veterans, warned him that he would die if he did not put a cork in the bottle, and he acquiesced, allowing them to take him into treatment. They were not in time. His last drunk, the one that hemorrhaged his liver and killed him, was paid for by the government, a first payment for post-combat distress, or whatever clinical name is in current use, for the horror war imprints upon its participants and victims. Cardwell was in Vietnam during the last years of the American part of the war, the worst time for soldiers when everyone was certain the war was almost over and none wished to be the last few to die or be permanently crippled. When he returned to the States, Cardwell drifted to the Oregon coast and lived in Cannon Beach for several years. He worked at odd jobs and lived in odd places, which included trucks, buses, back seats of cars, and sleeping bags in the woods or on the beach. He was, in the term disliked by those who fit it, a tripwire vet, though he did not retreat so completely into the wastes or rainforests and barricade himself behind barbed wire and trip flares. Inside of himself, he lived in a bunker never far from the war, whose shells and booby traps he escaped, which would destroy him nonetheless. His life after Vietnam took the quality of a bad dream he might have had while he was still there, a nightmare of what his life would be like if he managed to survive the war. Vietnam was the core of his life, as if both his birth and death were outer rings and of less consequence. Vietnam was his excuse for drinking, then it became his purpose, although at the end he might have wished he had chosen differently. It is said that suicides among Vietnam veterans equal those who were killed in the war, but it is a useless estimate. Another body count that cannot be trusted and is meaningless. It is now said that 22, I heard it on NPR this morning, 22 vets from our current wars have been committing suicide every month. The dead live inside the living, haunt them with sorrow and with guilt that they continue to survive, and beckon almost irresistibly for the survivors to rejoin their company. The living escape to dwell in a society that perpetrated the war and speeds past remorse and shame, unwilling to admit the genocide it provoked as a matter of policy. The survivors are continually requested to not discuss their experiences with war or death, to virtually excise that part of their lives from their thoughts and psyches, as if it were possible or desirable. After a while, it seems that only the dead understand them. It is a grim irony that those who fought so strenuously, so bitterly to survive, can find wholeness only in death. Like most Vietnam veterans, Cardwell hated the homecoming he received, and it seethed within him the rest of his life, embittering him. He was hurt and angry, but he went no farther. He was like so many others who became so engrossed in their own pain and bitterness that few moved beyond the narrow gauge of their anguish to attack the cause of their malignancy, which was not the undeserved contempt they received, but the war that inspired it. Their pathos is not that so many have been unable to readjust to an unsympathetic society that demands they lobotomize their experience, or that so many have destroyed themselves with drugs and alcohol, or have committed suicide in such large numbers. Their tragedy is their desperate, almost childlike wish to be taken back into the fold and honored as were their predecessors who fought in wars more accepted by the nation. The reality of Vietnam's consequences goes beyond the suffering of its soldiers or the Vietnamese with whom they are so intimately linked in terror, shame, and death. Vietnam veterans do not represent a lost war so much as they have acted as the nation's conscience in an affair in which the nation refused for too long to act morally against a pervasive and systematic destruction of a people and a culture considered inferior and of merely strategic consideration, and as a result, eroded much of its own integrity. Some of the nation's citizens acted against the immorality, but the subsequent embrace by many of the same stances that illuminated the war makes it necessary to question their integrity at the very moment they raised the issues to end the killing. They were the ones who originally condemned returning Vietnam veterans as baby killers, an unforgiving phrase the veterans have not forgiven. Vietnam veterans have been treated as lepers, shunned personally as being solely responsible for the war in which they were victims as much as their victims. People who hurt them have never quite gone far enough to see past the shame they have forced the veterans to bear. Reluctantly, hardly allowed any other choice, Vietnam veterans seem almost Christ-like in the sense that the nation, unable to bear the costs of its acquiescence to murder, has been content that its guilt and its crimes be carried by the soldiers it sent to do its dirty work. It has been an intolerable burden for the war survivors, added to the anguish and scars caused by the war itself, and it has destroyed many of them. The irony, of course, is the suspicion that the veteran's self-destruction has been a personal flaw of each, not the result of the unbearable cross they have been forced to carry by a faithless nation that judges them as weak for finding it too heavy. Like so many of his friends who survived the war, Paul Cardwell turned inward, which self-destructed him. But he also denied his lesson to those who might have learned from it, because his fear and bitterness they would not listen turned him against them. Ultimately, he denied what he might have offered history, or at least many of the young who have since learned in the same manner about how human beings, stripped of the thin sneer of civilization, really act toward one another. Underneath the spectacle of pageantry and the deceit of patriotism, the jarring presence of Vietnam veterans demonstrates with the subtlety of a clenched fist that war is death and horror, that it is murder and depravity, and that it makes sick the souls and minds of its executioners. Vietnam veterans give war a bad name. Paul Cardwell's name was on the long list of Vietnam War dead years before he died, although it will not be found on the black wall of the Vietnam Memorial. Unlike the nuclear shadows of Hiroshima burnt onto sidewalks and the sides of buildings, his own shrinks into private memories. I did not know him when he was belly crawling under fire or huddled low in a sandbagged bunker. I remember him later, back home, no longer attired in odious drab, his flak jacket replaced by one of old leather, a ragged straw hat in place of a steel helmet. I can't think of him without a quart bottle of beer or without his dog Sandoz, who followed him everywhere. His brothers were men who had been a part of the crippling horror, fellow outcasts and misfits he did not have to explain anything to. The war remained in his eyes, and finally, although it might be thought he had escaped, it closed them. And that was something I wrote some time back, and printed in the North Coast Times-Eagle. And I'd like to read a poem by Siegfried Sassoon, whom I started the program with. On passing the new Menin Gate. Who will remember, passing through this gate, the unheroic dead who fed the guns? Who shall absolve the foulness of their fate, those doomed, conscripted, unvictorious ones? Crudely renewed, the salient holds its own. Paid are its dim defenders by this pomp. Paid with a pile of peace-complacent stone, the armies who endured that sullen swamp. Here was the world's worst wound, and here with pride. Their name liveth forever, the gateway claims. Was ever an immolation so belied as those intolerably nameless names? Well might the dead who struggled in the slime rise and deride this sepulcher of crime. And that was by Siegfried Sassoon, who was an infantry officer in World War I, and actually attempted to dissent against the war, and was sent to a mental institution until he supposedly recovered, and he felt the only way out was to go back to the troops, which is the draw. That so-called survivor guilt, it's the draw. At any rate, happy Armistice Day this coming Monday, November 11th. I guess it's a holiday. I don't consider it such. I still think of it as Armistice Day, a prayer against war, not a celebration of it or of the people who fight in it. And this has been Michael McCusker. I might very well see you next week if certain things do not occur, including a drone scorching me on the sidewalk into a smoking piece of ash. This is KMUN and KTCB, Astoria, Kulamook, 91.9 FM and 89.5 FM, Coast Community Radio. And if I hit the right button, next up, NPR News Headlines, after maybe a second or two of blessed silence.